From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. Our topic on this edition of the program, the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the wake of the killing by Saudi agents of Jamal Khashoggi, an outspoken dissident and journalist who lived and worked in the United States. Our guest on this edition of the program is Yasmin Farouk. She's a visiting scholar in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and that's a foreign policy group based here in Washington. Her research focuses on Saudi Arabia and regional foreign relations. Prior to joining Carnegie, Yasmin Farouk was based in Egypt, where she taught political science. She previously worked at the office of the Egyptian Prime Minister after the 2011 Democratic Uprising, where she supported the role of civil society groups in the national dialogue and constitution-making processes. On this edition of the program, we'll talk with Yasmin Farouk about Saudi Arabia and the U.S.-Saudi relationship in the aftermath of U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo's recent swing through the region. His main goal was to reassure friends and partners that the U.S. commitment to remain engaged was unchanged, even as President Donald Trump announced plans to withdraw U.S. troops from northeastern Syria and to refocus attention on Iran's malign behavior as the root cause of regional insecurity and instability. Saudi Arabia is Iran's main rival and an old American ally, as well as the United States' biggest buyer of arms. But Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's actions are roiling the kingdom's relationship with Washington. Pompeo's visit with the de facto Saudi leader took place as Republican and Democratic lawmakers have been calling for a reevaluation of the U.S.-Saudi relationship, including its support for the Saudi-led military coalition in Yemen. Mr. Pompeo adhered closely to the U.S. administration's stance, which rejects the U.S. intelligence community's assessment that the order to kill Jamal Khashoggi in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2, 2018, likely came from Crown Prince Mohammed himself. While Pompeo pressed Riyadh for accountability, Washington consistently stresses the enduring nature of the U.S.-Saudi relationship and its vital role in countering Iran. So we'll talk with Yasmin Farouk, who joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Yasmin, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And as always, I'm so delighted to welcome my colleague and our in-house Middle East expert, Mohammed El-Shanawi.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Yasmin, let's take a look at the U.S.-Saudi relationship, particularly in the aftermath of the Khashoggi murder. We're also looking at the Saudis' intervention in Yemen, which is not going well at all. Do you think the United States still sees Saudi as an effective partner against Iran in light of all of these issues?
To answer this question, I have to highlight a problem that is today present in Washington, especially to those countries in the region, is that which U.S. are you talking about? Are you talking about the White House? Are you talking about the House? Are you talking about the Senate? Are you talking about the DOD? Are you talking about the State Department? So you have different and sometimes, I wouldn't say, conflicting statements coming out. But the problem with this region has always been that who else are you going to work with? You cannot ignore a country with the weight and the importance and the network and the resources of Saudi Arabia that are not actually comparable to other countries. So the U.S. needs to work with Saudi Arabia. Now, whether the U.S. still sees Saudi Arabia as an ally or something less than that is maybe changing now.
I mean, your point about multiple voices, often contradictory in the U.S. government, is very well taken. But of course, the White House still stresses the overarching importance of Saudi Arabia, notwithstanding the killing of Jamal Khashoggi. And there's, of course, this difference in opinion between many of the Republican and Democratic lawmakers who do point to the Crown Prince as most likely having ordered the murder. We have the assessment by our own intelligence community. How will this murder, whoever is to blame, you know, affect U.S.-Saudi relations going forward? Do you see any kind of punishment coming either from the Congress or some adjustment on the part of the White House with regard to how they see the Crown Prince in the wake of this very chilling event?
Well, you were very right to point that the administration actually is still, since the beginning, supporting them, the Crown Prince and the royal family and the Saudi regime as it is. So in that sense, given the role of the U.S. president in foreign policy, you can say in general that the U.S. still stands by Saudi Arabia and still stands by the Crown Prince. I think what is changing would be more debate inside Congress every time that there would be a new arms purchase by Saudi Arabia or a purchase of even defense systems. But we have seen in December and even in January that previous arms deals were cleared, but they were all defense with no offensive capacity. And they did pass. What will be interesting to watch, whether new deals of arms will be cleared by especially the Senate, when they will be presented by the Department of State and the U.S. administration.
Now a question from my colleague Mohammed.
Yasmin, President Trump ruled out a suspension of U.S. arms deals with Saudi Arabia because the Saudis would get their arms from Russia or elsewhere. What's your take on that?
The Saudis have already been using this card with the U.S., and not only the Saudis, but actually other Gulf states when they are in negotiations with the Russians to buy the S-400 defense systems. And then you had the U.S. replying with officials saying, well, the sanctions are on the table because by U.S. law, they can sanction the Saudis if they do so. It is a very slight possibility, given that it's very costly. Because given that the defense system and the arms system of Saudi Arabia is, in its vast majority, let's say, American, it will be costly, but it is not a far-fetched hypothesis. It can happen, but again, for the sake of putting pressure on the Americans rather than starting a complete change of the Saudi defense system, which I don't see happening, because this system is also linked to the other Gulf countries, so it would be very costly and very difficult.
But U.S. senators from both parties voted to condemn the Crown Prince. Would that pressure the administration to change its mind about dealing with Saudi Arabia?
Yes, in the sense that it will be under way more scrutiny. So all the channels that were going between the White House and the Saudi royal family or the Saudi Crown Prince will probably have to be revealed to the Congress and to the public. We've also seen a change inside Saudi Arabia because of that, with a slightly bigger role for the king himself, who had actually retreated, leaving especially foreign policy to the Crown Prince. Now we see the king is in the picture again, which means that the administration, as we saw happening after the Khashoggi crisis, will have to consider the king's positions, which are different on regional issues than those of the Crown Prince.
What do you see next for the Crown Prince and Saudi Arabia itself?
So the current mood in Saudi Arabia is, at least in the public, the royal family and the Crown Prince, of course, are trying to gear that mood toward the narrative that the crisis has passed and that the Crown Prince has overcome. And honestly, every time there is a pressure from the Americans on any government in this region, it's very easy to rally the public around the flag. So you kind of, they're trying to gear the public mood that we have overcome, but it's not necessarily true given the politics inside the Saudi regime itself. Because let's not forget how this Crown Prince became that powerful. He had made many victims, and many people are still looking for a chance to actually revenge from him. So this is still going on. You have also the commission that is responsible on voting on this Crown Prince, if his father ever dies, to whether he would become a king or not. We're not 100% sure that he will automatically become king. But his position is now 100% secure as long as his father is alive.
Well, that's really interesting because, again, many analysts are saying that Khashoggi's blood is a permanent stain on the Crown Prince, even if the White House doesn't accept that he was the one who probably ordered this killing. I mean, this is really a watershed moment. So he is seen by many analysts as not the stable, reliable monarch that is needed, but rather a force for instability. And of course, there's also the Yemen conflict, which he sent a Saudi-led coalition in back in March 2015, yeah. I believe. And since then, things have only gotten worse. The pretext was to thwart the rise of Iran, who were seen to be helping the Houthi, who were against the government at the time. But that has only deteriorated. We are seeing many civilian casualties. It's one of the world's worst humanitarian disasters. So again, it leads us to question, even if there's who's the alternative, it's a dangerous path to link the United States with this rather unstable monarch.
I agree with what you said. But again, one of the consequences, as I said in my previous answer, of this Khashoggi crisis was the fact that the king came back into the picture. So that's an element of stability that it's still to be seen. What impact will this have? We have seen its impact, for example, on the issue of the rapprochement with Israel, and the crown prince had made very daring statements, daring when you compare it to the Saudi position on Israel and the rest of the public position on Israel. And then we've seen, for example, the king rectifying this and taking it back to the traditional Saudi position in support of the Palestinians. So yes, he is an element of instability, but now you have the king back and we're still to see what is going to happen.
Well, we're going to take a break, but first to your points, which is, I think it's possible, as we say here in the United States, to walk and chew gum at the same time. The United States can have a strategic relationship with Saudi Arabia and still criticize, even impose sanctions on members of the Saudi government, restrict arms sales. So they're not inconsistent positions. I also believe, possibly, that Saudi Arabia can indeed have some kind of relationship with Israel, try to see Israel as a strategic partner against Iran, have secret talks, but it's at the same time still support the Palestinian cause. You're listening to Press Conference USA on The Voice of America. Our guest is Yasmin Farouk. She's a visiting fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. That's a prominent think tank based in Washington. I'm Carol Castiel, along with VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shanawi. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener in Kabul, Afghanistan, Zabilullah Lami. If you want to hear your name on the air, send us an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. And now to Mohammed for a question.
Yasmin, if the U.S.-Saudi relations are about mutual interests, what should the U.S. do to take advantage of the Saudi vulnerable position to get concessions that serve the interests of the United States in the region?
So the U.S. is really the single country with leverage on Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia has really global network of relations with China, with Russia, with European countries, but only the U.S. can actually exert the kind of pressure that is today needed on Saudi Arabia. And, you know, leaders in this region, whether the Saudi Crown Prince or others, are very, very pragmatic and they only understand concrete steps. Or let's say they do not feel threatened by a resolution from Congress because they know that at the end of the day, it's the U.S. president who decides on U.S. foreign policy. So the U.S. administration knows that is only arms deals and everything that is related to the defense of Saudi Arabia that can really make the Saudi royal family feel that they need a change in the behavior and that they need a change in policy. So the U.S. administration must, for the moment, let's say, I wouldn't necessarily say halt, but link all those arms purchases and its new projects of providing Saudi Arabia with new defense systems and link those to the conditions that the Trump administration relaxed. Those are the conditions related to human rights and good governance inside the countries to which the U.S. sells those arms. The Trump administration had started its administration by relaxing all those conditions on especially Bahrain and other countries. Those needs to come back. It is not about the U.S. interference inside those countries. It's about protecting U.S. interests, because if those countries are unstable and if this repression leads to more radicalization and terrorism, it's also U.S. interests that are threatened, and the U.S. again appears in the region as supporting dictators and supporting repression.
So how successful was the U.S. pressure to end the war in Yemen?
I think it is, despite the fact that the results, the outcomes of the Stockholm talks are not very promising because both sides have been violating it. But it's actually more the Houthis that have been violating for the time being. I think still we can say they have been successful. There's been a decrease in Saudi operations and there are talks today in Riyadh about a real need to find a political solution to the Yemen problem, but this solution will definitely involve U.S. guarantees and U.S. defense of Saudi Arabia, because let's not forget that the Houthis do conduct attacks on the border and they do attack Saudi troops inside Saudi Arabia on the other side of the border, and also they attack civilians.
another conflict, Syria, especially the fact that the United States, particularly Donald Trump, even against the advice of his own military, announced the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria, claiming that ISIS had been defeated, which now we know, objectively speaking, has not. How much progress was made by Mike Pompeo in reassuring both Saudi Arabia and other Gulf partners that this isn't going to affect U.S. engagement in the region?
Again, actions speak louder than words. And when you get different statements from different officials, and especially when you get the word of Mike Pompeo, but then a week later, President Trump says something else. Those leaders, yes, they do need the U.S., but they will start looking for alternatives for their protection. And so I do not expect that this tour had a deep impact in terms of reassuring those leaders that the U.S. is staying and the U.S. is protecting them, while President Trump has been consistently saying that he wants to retreat from the Middle East and that those countries will have to pay more for their protection and defense. They don't pay enough for us. So I think it was more of a tour to establish basis for U.S. policies, or try to establish basis and have allies to this U.S. policy, but it will not necessarily work. I mean, this is my opinion, except in places like Bahrain, for example, which they do not have any other choice, in smaller Gulf countries. But I don't think that the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians are really today 100% confident that they can rely on the U.S. for Middle East stability and security.
Let's turn now to another rift conflict in the region, which was precipitated by Saudi Arabia, Egypt, UAE, and Bahrain against Qatar. Qatar, who is a very crucial military partner of the United States, there's a huge air base there. But these other countries accuse Qatar of being too close to Iran, notwithstanding there are gas fields which they have in common. They accused Qatar of incitement through the Al Jazeera network. But we know now from Mike Pompeo's visit that the United States would like this rift to end. They see it damaging to their ultimate goal of thwarting and combating Iran's hegemony. Did Mike Pompeo do anything to convince, in your view, Saudi Arabia and these other countries, Egypt, Bahrain, and the UAE, to end this rift?
Well, this was an important item of the agenda that he discussed in all of the countries, not only the countries involved in the rift, but also in other countries like Oman that is not involved in this rift. And I believe that he was about to speak about it in Kuwait, but then he had to cut his trip and come back home for a family funeral. It is true that this rift today is what is actually blocking any kind of U.S. reliance on its allies or any kind of collective mechanism to restore stability in this region. I must admit, the number one threat to those countries is when other countries meddle in their domestic affairs. And Qatar has been doing this since 2011. And so did the others. So I think that this is the basis for ending this rift. It's not about that Al Jazeera having media campaigns against those countries. It's also because Qatar, where Al Jazeera is based, is hosting dissidents from all those countries and is using dissidents from all those countries. So if there is a mutual engagement from those countries to halt the meddling in the domestic affairs of each other, I think other points would be easier to discuss and to find compromise on. For example, another rift is on their foreign policy in regional crises. But we haven't seen this causing really a rift between Oman and Saudi Arabia, who really don't have the same positions in regional crises, and neither between Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, for example. It is really about their reciprocal meddling in their domestic affairs, and this is what needs to stop. I think the U.S. is very serious about finding reconciliation, but we have seen the resignation of the U.S. envoy who was in charge of this, General Anthony Zinni. We have been heard very disappointed statements from Secretary Pompeo, but also from Mattis before he resigned. So it is still the big issue in the region.
Exactly. And again, it illustrates the conflicting voices, because initially, President Trump actually backed the four countries in their accusations against Qatar. And so now they're backtracking on that, saying, no, you need to reconcile. So that makes it all the more difficult when you have these conflicting voices within the administration.
Another point, Yasmin, what do you think the Trump administration has for Saudi Arabia a role in facilitating the so-called deal of the century to settle the Palestinian-Israeli conflict?
That's one of the issues where when you're in Washington, you get a completely different perspective than when you are in the region. So the Crown Prince, when he came to visit the U.S. and then when he met U.S. media, he made several statements that not only gave the impression, but confirmed his orientation or his willingness to have normal relations with Israel. And then you had reports about the transfer of technology from Israel to Saudi Arabia, but also to the UAE. But at the same time, right after the statements that he made that were friendly towards Israel when he was here in the U.S., you had the king dubbing the Arab summit that took place in Saudi Arabia the Jerusalem summit and, making statements in other public appearances that were not linked to the Palestinian question about Palestine. For example, the speech he made in front of the Shura Council by the end of last year, and then his public speeches afterwards, he consistently mentions his support to the Palestinians. Saudi Arabia has been one of the biggest Arab donors to the UNRWA, even after the U.S. has decided to cut aid. So I would be really cautious if we are to be optimistic about relations between Saudi Arabia and Israel. It will not be easy. The Palestinian issue is still important in the Saudi public and in the Saudi media. The narrative still hasn't changed.
But could the Saudis, with this newfound sort of alliance against Iran between Israel and Saudi Arabia, could they get to the government, whoever that may be after the elections, and say, look, you need to make some concessions here and there? I mean, in the interest of their larger goal of combating and trying to fight against Iran's influence.
There is a difference between working with the Israelis against Iran and then working with the Israelis against what is considered to be Palestinian rights. So the public and even the most conservative elements inside the Saudi regime would accept out of pragmatism to cooperate with Israel, but it doesn't necessarily mean that those same elements will accept an opening on Israel that will violate Palestinian rights or that would mean that Saudi Arabia is abandoning the Palestinians.
I see. I was just hoping that perhaps the Saudi government or the monarchy could, in exchange for increased cooperation against Iran, say to the Israelis, look, you need to make these concessions to the Palestinians, but not sure if that would actually happen, if they have that kind of influence with the Israeli government.
They have tried the King Abdullah peace plan that afterwards became the Arab peace plan with a Saudi idea. It was a breakthrough, especially coming from King Abdullah, who was crown prince before becoming king when this plan was revealed, especially that he was known for being very pro-Arab and pro-Arab unity. So they have tried this before. The only hope has always been that the U.S. would put more pressure on the Israelis, which we don't at all see happening now.
Given the aftermath of the Khashoggi murder and gruesome dismemberment and the repercussions this will continue to have on the Saudi monarchy and relations between the United States and Saudi Arabia, the role of the Saudis in the Yemen civil war, etc. Are the Saudis the bulwark against Iran that they really claim to be? Or through these various actions, are they, inadvertently emboldening Iran?
Well, it wasn't the Saudis that emboldened Iran in the region. It was the American intervention in Iraq in 2003. And, the Saudis had warned the Americans about this and have been trying to work with the Americans about this in Iraq, and it didn't work. And today, Iran has become what it has become. Its network that is already had across the Arab world is even more powerful and active than before. So, yes, the Saudis are, but I don't believe that the objectives of the anti-Iran strategies are the same between Saudi Arabia and the United States.
No, I do take your historical point. And I was more referring to the mismanagement of Saudi Arabia in Yemen and other actions it's taking that only sort of allow Iran to continue to engage in malign activities.
Of course, you have a very good point there, because the Saudis have not been managing this rising Iranian power very well. And in some sense, yes, they did help them become more powerful, especially in Yemen.
In the past, the U.S.-Saudi Arabia relations was focusing on energy. Now it's mostly focusing on countering Iran and combating terrorism. How would the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi affect such historic relations?
Again, it really depends who is sitting in the White House. Because with the current administration, we get the impression that it had no effect at all, aside from the administration, because of pressure from the Congress, having to make statements that may seem embarrassing to the Saudi royal family, like saying that we talked to the Saudi royals about the need for accountability and holding every single person involved, and about the general situation of human rights in Saudi Arabia. We haven't really seen the administration putting more pressure on the Saudis because of the crime itself, but actually because of the U.S. Congress pressure on the administration. Again, in terms of concrete consequences, I haven't seen from the administration any concrete change in the relation to Saudi Arabia.
Does that hurt the American moral standing in the world?
First of all, of course, yes. But second of all, you are talking about the Middle East, and the past 20 years have seen American military interventions in the Middle East. You still have the memory of the, you know, the prisoners being tortured in Iraq. So it's fair to say that the Middle East public have very low expectations from the United States when it comes to defending its human rights against the dictators in place. It doesn't mean that the U.S. hadn't been doing it, and sometimes the U.S. has done it in very efficient ways, because sometimes it's way more efficient to talk in private to those dictators than to shame them in public. But I'm talking to you about the perception that this public in general has. But of course, if it does anything, it confirms that the U.S. is siding with the dictators against the people.
And on that note, as we close, what about the Crown Prince's crackdown on internal dissent and his repression and incarceration of women? We know that, again, Mike Pompeo supposedly broached this topic of human rights, including allegations regarding acts of torture against jailed women's rights activists who've suffered lashings, electric shocks. And one has to wonder whether all the so-called economic reform efforts that the Crown Prince has championed and supposedly implemented, to what extent these are offset by not just the Khashoggi murder, but these continued acts of repression against women, notwithstanding the right to drive, because there's so many contradictions.
That's very true. But let me first say that, yes, he did make some meaningful social reforms. But if he wasn't that powerful, he wouldn't have been able to implement reforms such as letting women drive and imposing women in some of the economy sectors. So he did do that. But at the same time, as you said, there is a rising repression inside Saudi. And it's not only really about women. It's about any voice that is even suspected of not agreeing with his line or with his reforms. So I do understand the defense of women, because they are really the weakest in these voices, and they were the easiest to crush in such a conservative society. But he has also imprisoned economists. He has also imprisoned religious leaders who, again, did not publicly voice disagreement with him, but who were suspected of disagreeing with him. And this is something very dangerous, because in Saudi Arabia, I've always traditionally had a mixture of between repression, imprisonment, but also cooptation, bribery, buying those dissident voices and buying in opposition. Today, we only see one response, which is repression. But the U.S. needs to be careful not to focus just on women and to make a difference between attacking Saudis, quote-unquote, and between addressing just the Saudi government. Because today we're seeing voices on Twitter and elsewhere saying that the Americans are just focusing on women, as if, you know, the rest are not important, or the Americans are focusing on women because they want to change our society, and they want, you know, they are targeting our religion, they're targeting our values. There is an alarming rise in repression inside Saudi Arabia that should be addressed across sectors.
And indeed, and shouldn't be masked by the so-called economic reforms.
Of course not. Of course not. And this was really naive from the rest of the world to just jump to conclusion that because he is young, because he is very daring, that this means that automatically he's going to do only good things. No.
A very complicated portrait of Saudi Arabia and the U.S.-Saudi relationship by Yasmin Farouk. She's a visiting fellow in the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Yasmin, thank you for coming in and sharing your terrific insights with us.
Thank you for having me.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Patrice Martin for booking our guest. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. And joining me on the program was VOA senior Middle East reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.